Hey, everybody, and welcome to Vassals of Kingsgraves, Agatha Christie linear reread. We are now on episode 15. It's 1934. Agatha is 44 years old, and this is Murder on the Orient Express, which must be one of her most famous books. My name is Bina 007. I am your host, and I'm absolutely overjoyed to say that I am joined today by Xander.
Bonjour. It is Xander, also the Lord Baron.
And by Hannah.
Bonjour. What do you think? You're better than me? I'm just kidding. It's Hannah, the Winged Shadow on the Discord.
Wonderful. And hopefully we're going to be joined by Peter Nesca, a new podcaster. We've had a few technical issues with Craig recording on Discord and then Skype. So we're now recording on Zoom. Hopefully the audio quality is just as crappy as you expect from Vok. And they make it over here. This is the third switch we've made. So much like the murder in this, you have to evolve with changing circumstances. As always, we're going to start off not spoiling the book. So we're going to talk a bit about context and characters and how we find it. And then after the end credits music, we'll get into the plot and who did it. This is one of the most famous murders. So even if you haven't read it, you might know the solution. If you haven't, I would encourage you to read it, and please don't spoil yourself. But anyway, let's get into it. How would you rate this novel? Or is it the first time you've read it? Hannah, is this one of your favorites?
This one's not one of my like personal favorites of hers. It doesn't crack top five for me, only because it doesn't have the same rereadability to me as some of her other ones. This one, you cannot like forget the solution to me. It's sort of a departure in that way, but it also is a very true whodunit. And I can see why it's one of her most popular, certainly. So it's not that I dislike it. It's just that there are other ones like Crooked House, the ABC Murders, Endless Night. And then there were none that are stylistically, the writing is more complex and has a very different voice that I appreciate more. But this one is great. This is the first Hercule Poirot, I believe, that I read personally.
Oh,
I think
wow.
It was
what a way to get
the second Christie I read. So I think, and yeah. Then there were none was first, and then I did this one. It's been a long time. I've reread it several times. It's just, you know, you do know what happens. So
yeah, I feel exactly the same way. It's not in my personal top five. It's probably in my top 10, probably because the plot contrivance is so audacious that once you know it, it does diminish it a little bit on a reread. And also maybe just because of all her closed mysteries, it's the most closed because it's all in a train carriage. So right. It really is just the murder happens, Poirot interviews all the suspects, thinks about it, and then gives the solution. So there's no action, nothing happens, there's no variation. So to me, it is very hermetically sealed.
For being on a train, it's even more sealed off because it's just the Calais coach, right?
Like, yeah, you're just in the Calais coach surrounded by a snowdrift and you don't do anything. How about you, Xander? Was this the first time you read it? Have you read it before? Did you know the solution before you read it?
I went in completely blind with this one.
Wow.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun.
How did you find it without spoiling it?
I think one of the best things about this book is how subtly hilarious Agatha Christie is. Whereas you're reading, you don't even realize she's making a joke, you know, but I was just cracking up to myself.
Yeah, she's a subversive writer. This is what I've been trying to hammer home to people, that sometimes she is prejudiced, sometimes she's mocking it. I think there's a lot of mocking at the expense of people like Colonel Arbuthnot and the more stuffy characters, for sure. And how, like, the Italians hate the French and vice versa. And, you know, Monsieur Bouc, who runs the train line, always thinks, oh, it must be the Italian, you know, because he's French. Yeah, there's a lot going on here in terms of how different people view each other, for sure. Well, I'm glad you enjoyed it. Do you think it played fair? Do you think that the ending plays fair with the reader?
That I'm not so convinced of.
Mm.
But obviously, I'll probably form a better opinion as we discuss it.
Yeah.
But that is something else I like too, like as you're pointing out, like the way, you know, she's poking fun of it, or it's her own actual kind of bias. The way she writes so plainly about these almost stereotypes, to me, kind of even feels like how Mark Twain just wrote exactly how people spoke and were. And it almost acts as like a mini time capsule.
Yeah, absolutely. Which again is why I love this. You know, 1934 is a very momentous period in world history. And just to hear for Europe, right, it's an interesting period in Europe. And just to see how the different nationalities and classes are commenting on each other is really quite interesting. And how they're pastiching sometimes, because there's a lot of people here who are adopting different identities as well. Okay, so let's get into it. Let's set up for the listener who maybe hasn't read it or heard of it, which strikes me as amazing, and maybe tempt them into this. So we start off, there is the famous Orient Express train. In fact, this was the subject of two books at the time. In 1932, Graham Greene brought out a novel called The Stamboul Train. And so they actually call this The Murder on the Calais Coach in the US to distinguish it from that book. But the Orient Express is still a train that you can take today, and it runs from Istanbul all the way through Central Europe up to Paris, and then you can take the boat train over to London. So, and it takes 4 days. So it's a very historic line. And obviously the Calais coach is the most luxurious part of it. It's where, you know, it's very luxurious. There's fine dining. There's two people per compartment. That's quite important. And you might find very wealthy nobles on board. And Hercule Poirot is coming back from a case, and he ends up trying to find a berth on this coach, which is apparently very full for the time of year, which is surprising. And he's approached by someone called Ratchet, who says, I'll pay you whatever you want, but I need someone. I feel in danger. Someone's sending me threatening letters. I want you to try and, you know, protect me. And Poirot gets a very visceral hatred for this person, says, no, I'm not going to do it. And the next morning, he's found dead in, he, Ratchet, not Poirot, is found dead in his carriage with 12 stab marks. And what's unusual is some of them are very light, some of them are very heavy, some look left-handed, some look right-handed. So they discover this murder. The train has stopped in the middle of the night because it's been hit by a snowdrift. And the representative of the train company asks Poirot to investigate and says, you know, when the train is freed of its snow and we finally pull into a station and the local police force, it would be so much easier for me from a business perspective if we could just give them a solution. So as I said before, the novel is basically Poirot looking at the evidence in the carriage, interviewing the different people, and then unveiling his solution. How did you guys find the Orient Express as a setting? There are some people who are obsessed by these famous train journeys, including myself, but how did you find it as a description of a bygone era of travel?
Well, I've never traveled by train for realsies, and I
not like very that. Much,
yeah, I very much felt like I've never traveled by train at all, like Amtrak or anything. We don't really have them out here, so I did find that she paints the picture of the train where I felt like I could really envision it and feel like what she's saying. I will say. So I read this many, many, many years ago, and the last two times I've tackled it have been via the BBC radio play. You don't realize the noise until it's gone, and then they comment on how quiet it is without the train moving.
And it must have been eerie, right?
It's really great. If you've never listened to it, give it a listen. It's fantastic.
And it must have been eerie, right? If you go from a noisy platform and an overcrowded carriage and the noise of the steam train, and then suddenly you were in a snowdrift, must have been very spooky.
Yeah.
And apparently happened all the time. So apparently the inspiration of the novel is Agatha Christie's first journey on the Orient Express was in late 1928. And she was caught in a blizzard on the train, and it was marooned for 6 days. When she got to hope it doesn't run out of food, right? So that's kind of where the idea probably came to her. And then apparently when her husband, she was coming back by that point, she'd married her second husband, who was an archaeologist and did a lot of work in Baghdad. So they used to take the train back a lot. And apparently that was also halted for 24 hours because rain washed a section of the track away. So very, very luxurious, but also very precarious, apparently, due to weather.
Yeah, at least you find out though and are able to stop the train.
Yeah, exactly. Cool. It's also that the novel looks different to others because it has kind of proper chapters where it has, you know, the first part is called The Facts, and then it's called The Evidence, and then it's called Hercule Poirot sits back and thinks, Xander, you're a fan of the Hercule Poirot.
That's accurate, though.
Yeah, exactly. Accurate. Does what it says on the tin. How did you find Poirot in this? And how did you find him without Hastings and without Inspector Japp? Did you prefer this pure essence of Poirot? Do you feel you got to know him better?
Yeah, definitely. Especially because I think Poirot in this novel, he's almost just like enjoying himself the whole time. Like he's indulging himself, you know, in this whole mystery. And I think in a weird sense of the way, he's both very tired, but at the same time, very much enjoying himself because this is what he knows. This is what he's good at, you know.
He still finds a sidekick though. You know what I mean? Like he has.
Oh yeah, friend. Definitely.
And that was one of the telling things to me is like, even though she doesn't like the formulaic thing with Hastings and stuff, she still manages to bring in the person who doesn't know. I think you kind of have to in a mystery novel. Very you have important. To bring in somebody to be the audience.
Exactly. You've got to have someone that Poirot can explain his methods to. And it's very clearly stated that Monsieur Bouc works on behalf of the train company, but also was sleeping in the second class coach. So he cannot be a suspect, which is why Poirot can trust him. But yeah, we need to have that figure.
That she ever gets away from that is by having in books like Crooked House and Endless Night, it's a narrator instead.
Exactly. Third person. Exactly. But in the Poirot novels, it's often, I mean, this one is third person because Hastings isn't there. So it's not his memoirs, but you're right. He needs someone to explain to, but I do like this because I think it is very pure Poirot. We've established that he's not Sherlock Holmes, right? He doesn't go looking for physical clues, that he is all about the little gray cells. And what could be more pure than just sitting and having to consider character and people? Speaking of which, these are the characters. You've got Hercule Poirot, Monsieur Bouc, who is his friend and a director of the train company. You've got Dr. Constantine, who's a Greek doctor, who was also not in the first class carriage, so isn't under suspicion. So they're the kind of three investigating people. Then in the first class carriage, you've got Mrs. Hubbard, who's meant to be a very kind of loud, brash American, but almost a caricature of the kind of American abroad. You've got Miss Mary Debenham, who's a very upright English governess. Colonel Arbuthnot, who's an ex-army man. You've got a Russian princess in the wake of the Russian Revolution, Princess Dragomirov, who seems to be very intimidating and grand. You've got Mr. Ratchet, the murder victim, who comes with his secretary, Mr. McQueen, his, I guess, valet, Mr. Masterman. And then you've got a couple who are diplomats, the Count and Countess Andreini, who seem to be very glamorous and young, and she seems quite disturbed. But they have diplomatic immunity, which is really interesting. And then you've got Mr. Hardman, who we're not really quite sure about him. He says he's a car salesman. Mr. Foscarelli, you've got Greta Olsen and Hildegard Schmidt. So you've got a Swede and a German, and Pierre Michel, the train conductor, who's French. So there's a lot of different nationalities on board, a lot of different classes of people, from the sort of the servants to the aristocrats to the diplomats to Ratchet. He's the very, very rich murder victim. So it's a real mixed bag of people. I think to date, it's the most mixed bag of characters we've had. It's kind of one place, but the whole world is on it. Do any of you have any particular characters you like? Well, Xander, you said some of it was quite funny. Are there any characters that you felt were quite, or situations you felt were quite funny?
I think it really just comes down to how Poirot interacts with them. I'm trying to think of a specific example, but even just, you know, just getting on the train and seeing people and briefly talking to some people, he's just such a funny little man, as he's often described.
He is. And she does sometimes poke fun at him as well too, right? But anyway,
I do really feel for Monsieur Bouc in this one. Like, his position is so precarious with the company, you know, and wanting to, like, the motive of bringing Poirot in to, like, we can't wait for the police because we need to keep it hush. Like, I do feel for people in the service industry who have, like, a certain clientele and feel pressured to
obnoxious go a little bit
outside the law. Yeah, in like extraordinary circumstances.
Yeah.
You know,
well, we'll get into that right in the spoiler section about how far Poirot feels that pressure as well. Like, you can understand Monsieur Book feeling it, but yeah, let's get into the concept of justice in the spoiler section, because we'll have a lot to say about that. Before we get there, let's quickly get through how the novel stands up to modern standards and also adaptations, the standard things that we do. So in terms of whether it's regressive rather than progressive, this wasn't one of the worst novels, I felt, for some of the dated language about different races. But Colonel Arbuthnot is very old-fashioned English, and, you know, Poirot correctly reads his English mind, only some damn foreigner. So in a way, Agatha Christie is kind of maybe mocking Colonel Arbuthnot for being very old-fashioned and parochial. At one point, Hardman refers to his quote-unquote WOP relations, which is not a word we would use nowadays and did stand out. And there's a lot of like...
Oh my God.
I know, just horrific, right? And there's a lot of like stereotyping that from Book, where he's like, oh, well, the crime must be Latin or female because it's frenzied. And he's always thinking of Italians as having done it, because, and at one point he says to Poirot, do not Italians stab?
Yeah.
But I feel that Agatha Christie's kind of mocking it rather than,
anti-Italianism after World War One was a pretty prevalent thing in English and French culture. And
yeah, absolutely. They were the enemy,
like,
right?
I can really blame them. You know what I mean? Like, you go through something like that and you lose an entire generation of young men to the meat grinder there.
I think your point, Hannah, is a really good one, that it's important to remember that when people are reading this, it is basically just 10, 15 years after World War One, and there will be sentiment. And also that, you know, Italy is now under Mussolini, and there are things kicking off in the League of Nations about Abyssinia, and there is conflict brewing, right? So that kind of prejudicial comment.
Yeah, looking down the barrel of it again, you know, when they're still barely recovering from it before. Like, Peaky Blinders is a really good example of this kind of tension with Italians and Englishmen.
But it's interesting because it hasn't cropped up in Agatha Christie's novels to date. This is the first one where you really see that. And I do wonder if it is in response to world events. There's a lot of talk about faces in this book as well, which is a bit nasty and a bit sort of phrenology style or racial phrenology. So at one point, Adrenny can't be English. There's something about the cheekbones, quote unquote. Hardman has quote unquote coarse fleshy features. And there's a reference to the swarthy Italian face of Boscarelli. So there's a lot of quite pejorative descriptions of non-English people as not having refined features, which is really horrible to read. But I guess, like you say, it would have been in the air at the time, partly reflecting what's happened in World War One and partly the kind of the run up to World War Two. But it really does kind of it just makes you realize what's going on in the background, which is really, really sad. But at least there's not the horrific anti-Semitism we had in the last couple of books that we read together. So there's something.
It's kind of funny because it's almost like reverse anachronistic, because it is written in, you know, a modern world and modern language. And then, yeah, it's only kind of those, whether she's, you know, unintentionally believing it or poking fun at whatever stereotype or anything. It almost seems like conflicting with the rest of it.
Mm. But like, modern language is an odd phrase to use, because this is almost 90 years old too. Like,
but it is very modern, isn't it? I mean, that's the amazing thing, that it doesn't read, you know, that different to how you would read a book these days. I think that's why they remain so popular, because it's a basically modern language. I mean, some of the brand names and the references might be different, and we can get into that actually with the adaptations. But unfortunately, reader, listener, in fact, I'm going to do the adaptations in the spoiler part of this episode, because I don't know how we can discuss them without discussing the plot twist. So this is a very, very short spoiler-free part of the episode. I hope we've whetted your appetite to read this book. It really is one of the most famous detective stories ever written. So even if you don't normally read murder mysteries, why would you be listening to this episode? But if you do and you haven't read it, please do pick it up, because it is very ingenious and you will likely enjoy it, especially if it's for the first time. But with that, we hope you've enjoyed listening so far. And for those of you who have read it or seen the films, we'll join you after this end music. Okay, folks, we can talk about the ending. Xander, you've never read it before. What did you think when you discovered that they all did it?
I don't know. I'm not sure if, because like, I don't know if that's satisfying or not.
I think, though, Bina, when you asked, does it play fair? I think it absolutely does, because immediately it tells you that 12 people did it. You just don't realize it, but immediately stab wound is like short and weak. This stab wound is tall and fierce. Like it automatically points to forensically at least more than one killer.
So I think there's more than one. I'm not sure we know it's all 12, though.
Yeah, and I think maybe that's my dissatisfaction with it. Maybe it's just that I'm not appreciating just the sheer organizing and deduction on both ends between the murderers and Poirot. Maybe I was looking for something maybe like a bit more interesting with only a couple people. But again, I only read it the one time, so going back to reread it, I might feel differently.
This is the one that I know, like, we had this chat about justice and vigilantism during Peril at End House, but when you referred to them as murders, that jarred me so hard. I'm like, no, they're not murderers. They're the jury. Like that is the takeaway I get from this, is like, they're a jury. You wouldn't call a jury that votes for a death penalty a bunch of murderers, but that's what they do too. Like,
maybe that's the other pressing point for me. And I know that the way she quite literally ends the novel with Poirot saying, all right, here it is. Now you think about it. I think as interesting as his deduction is to figuring out what happened, I think the more interesting conversation point of her book is the idea of vigilantism versus justice.
Very quickly, doesn't he? I mean, the ending of the novel between the solution and him deciding to let them go, because he presents the two options, right? It's very quick. We don't really see him mull it over in great depth and have great tortured ethical crises of conscience. He pretty much decides, what could the kidnapper of little Daisy Armstrong did was so horrible that he's going to let them go. And to me, it's almost like it's not even the decision to let the vigilantes get away with it. It's the fact that it's so quick for him.
I think because it's not so much a question of, is this justice? It's obvious that it's justice. That part of it is black and white. The question lies in, is Ratchet evil or not? Is there evil in the world? And I think Poirot, before the novel begins, really in his first interaction, has already made that assessment of him, that he's evil.
Yeah, but one way or another, he shouldn't run away. I find that troubling as well. Like, there's a point where Poirot sees Ratchet, as he then thinks he is, at the hotel before they get on the train, and he says, Poirot finds something viscerally animalistic and savage about him. And for someone who's so logical and little gray cells, it's almost like he's made a very emotional reaction, which is why he won't protect him. And why he, I suppose, ultimately comes to the conclusion that he's not going to prosecute the vigilantes. I don't think it is a clear cut, like, this is the right thing to have done. I think I would have arrested them and had them try, but then leave it to an actual jury to say, do you want to say, I don't know.
I don't think he's being emotional. I think that the subtext is, what's the last thing he says to him? To be honest, I don't like your face. And Poirot has somewhat of an eidetic memory, and he's saying without saying, and she's saying without telling the reader, he recognizes him and he knows who he is.
I didn't take that.
Some level, at least, whether he actively remembers it and puts it together with that or not, I think he knows his face and he knows that he doesn't like him. And there's a reason.
Is that what you got from it, Xander? Yeah,
I didn't. That is kind of interesting, just like, because, you know, it's a very well-known case to him. No, I mean, I could totally see him subconsciously recognizing, and, you know, just his natural instincts, knowing who the person was. But I also, when I was reading, before you find out who Hatchet really is, in my head, even though I knew, you know, he was going to turn out to be a horrible person, in my head, I'm wondering, was Poirot culpable with his murder because he declined taking the case. But obviously, you know, you read two more pages and that's not a thing you think about anymore.
Yeah, but there is not a dereliction of duty. He's a private detective, but you know, there is something to be said for the fact that if you believe in a true form of justice, I tend to be more on that side, that I would want to see justice being done through the court system. But it is provocative, and that's in a way why I love it as a book. But it's also why I feel it kind of fails on a reread, because it's sort of, once you know the solution, it's actually very obvious, because like you say, as soon as you know the 12 different stab marks, and also you've got to put yourself in the mind of people reading this in 1934, which is literally 2 years after the Charles Lindbergh kidnapping. So
Coors baby, right?
Yeah, exactly. And it's the Lindbergh baby case, which was so internationally famous, effectively caused the setting up of the FBI. I mean, this was huge news, wasn't it? And before we always realized that Charles Lindbergh was a crypto Nazi, so when they were still popular as people. But it's so in people's brains when they're reading this that, I don't know, I find as a modern reader, it's very difficult, isn't it? Because when you see all the adaptations, they kind of have to somehow reveal the crypto Lindbergh murder so that we have it in our heads, because otherwise how would he solve it? So I'm not sure it does play fair. It kind of overplays fair because of the 12 different stab marks, and then giving us the daisy, like the little bit of paper that he somehow manages to read the writing on. But on the other hand, I find, I don't know, to me, it's very famous, but it feels very unsatisfying on many, many levels, not least whether it's playing fair. And also because I think these interesting questions of vigilantism aren't really addressed in the book. They're left to us afterwards.
I really do feel with how methodical he is, what a fantastic memory. He's a factotum, right? I feel like especially something that's splashed all over the papers worldwide that's pertaining to his field, he knows who that guy is. He knows who he is. And I've never felt like there's any indictment for him not taking the case. Quite frankly, the way Ratchet approaches him is, you know, not really with a lot of evidence in hand. He doesn't see that letter. He doesn't produce it. You know, quite frankly, anyone could be like, well, go to the police if you're that worried. You know, that's not the same as him actually producing some hard evidence he's in peril, or there's someone stalking him with a gun. He jumps behind Poirot and then Poirot stands out of the way. That's not quite the same. So as far as Poirot knows, it's unsubstantiated. And I think it's well within your right to fail to render aid under those circumstances. And you have a choice whether to get involved or not.
Far as within his rights. I just think it's interesting how different times tell us different attitudes to vigilantism, right? Because obviously for Agatha Christie, and we're going to see this in other books, she does have a very kind of... She's got a very strong sense of good and evil, and that evil must be punished. And then if it's not going to be punished in the court system, Poirot can be the agent of that punishment, right? So she obviously thinks this is very straightforward. And what fascinates me is, because this was written 90 years ago, we've had many adaptations, and it feels like the attitudes towards the type of justice rendered have changed over the years. So the very first film was the 1974 Sidney Lumet adaptation, which was a very big budget, massively expensive one. She was very unhappy with adaptations of her books, but finally gave in, and this was the one they picked. It stars Albert Finney as Hercule Poirot, who looks like a cross between Charlie Chaplin and Hitler. I don't think it's a successful performance, but you've got really amazing people like Lauren Bacall as Mrs. Hubbard, Sean Connery as Arbuthnot, Sir John Gielgud as Beddoes, Anthony Perkins as McQueen, Dame Vanessa Redgrave as Mary Debenham, Dame Wendy Hiller as the Princess, Michael York as the Count, Ingrid Bergman won a flipping Oscar for being Greta Olsen. Have either of you watched this one?
No,
I haven't watched any of them.
Lauren Bacall,
it's definitely worth it. You can rent it on Amazon Prime in the UK for like £3 or whatever, and it's really worth seeking out because it's very loyal and honest to the book. It's very straightforward, but it's just got everyone in it. And it's Sean Connery is Arbuthnot. It's just an amazing, amazing adaptation. I think everyone's really good apart from Hercule Poirot. But what's interesting is it opens with the Armstrong murder. So it opens with that as a prequel. It's very celebratory at the end. So once he lets them all get off, the guy who plays the valet, so John Gielgud, comes out with, you know, a tray of champagne, and they all toast each other with champagne, and they're all laughing, and they're like, yeah, we did it. We brought him to justice. Happy days. It's incredibly straightforward. Yeah, there's no conscience in that one whatsoever. We're going to skip over the 2001 CBS Al Molina one, but if you're an Al Molina fan, you can find that on YouTube. It's really weird because they update it to modern times, but modern times obviously date much harder than 1934, so there's TVs on board the train and a handheld computer with a stylus, like a palm pilot. It's hilarious. But no, it's terrible. So don't watch that. But you can, if you just want to like see Al Molina not do a Belgian accent, then feel free to watch that.
Palm pilots were terrible.
Yeah. And they're like, you know, a mobile phone the size of a brick. It's hilarious. And then there's a really good one in the ITV series in 2010 starring David Suchet. And it's got Toby Jones as Ricchetti. You've got Jessica Chastain, a very young Jessica Chastain, as Miss Debenham before she was famous. Barbara Hershey is Mrs. Hubbard. Dame Eileen Atkins is the princess. Uncle Benjamin is Foscarelli.
Oh, wow.
Again, it's worth seeking out if you can get it. But the reason I'm bringing it up is, in contrast to the 1974 one, in this one, almost the entire second half of it is David Suchet's Poirot, you know, getting really Catholic and saying, you know, literally saying the rosary and should I let these people off? Is justice God's? Has God failed these people? And he has this whole kind of like ethical debate with Jessica Chastain as Miss Debenham about what the nature of justice. And you get the feeling that, you know, even though he lets them off, he's really unhappy about it. He'll never forget it. And it's really dark and brooding. And that they themselves, as the 12, will never get over it either. They're like hugely damaged by it. And it's really interesting because the opening of the film starts with a woman in Istanbul being stoned for adultery, and Poirot kind of quite smugly says to the person with him, well, this is their culture, so you've got to allow them to do it. And he's then obviously kind of at the end in that same position. So I don't know, do you think that tells us something about our times, our obsessions? I don't know, the feel, maybe we just feel we need to give it more consideration, but it gives it, I mean, it's just, you know, so much angst that isn't in the books at all.
Did you see the latest one they did? What was it, 2019, 2018?
2017, the Kenneth Branagh one.
I watched it, but I don't remember disliking it, but I don't remember like loving it either.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm a bit mad on that. I mean, it's also got a great cast, right? It's got Dame Judi Dench. I'm smiling at my husband because he hates her. National Treasure. Dame Judi Dench is the princess. Willem Dafoe is Hardman. Penelope Cruz is Greta Olsen. Johnny Depp as Cassetti. So Derek Jacobi is Masterman. Leslie Adam Jr. as Dr. Arbuthnot. Daisy Ridley, Mary Debenham, Michelle Pfeiffer as Mrs. Hubbard. It's, again, very star-studded. And again, this one gives Poirot ethical qualms, right? He is worried about whether to let them off. And the way he solves it in this one is he gives them a gun and he says to them, if you want to get away with it, shoot me. And they refuse to do that because they're not arbitrary killers. And that proves to him that they are seeking actual justice. They're not just killing for the sake of it. And so he lets them off. So in a way, that was quite a neat solution. And in that one, the big ethical debate is with Mrs. Hubbard, Michelle Pfeiffer. But again, like the David Suchet one, when he lets them off, you get the feeling that they are permanently scarred and that Mrs. Hubbard in particular is going to live a really haunted life. So it's just incredibly different, right? Maybe it's the times we live in where we feel people can't be allowed to get away with it. So we have to punish Poirot and we have to punish them even though they have gotten away with it. Whereas in 1974 and 1934, it was just very straightforward. Yeah, they got away with it. Great. The bad guy's dead. The good guys survive. Happy days. And we're now imposing a much more nuanced, I don't know, ethics onto it. What do you guys think?
I would agree with that. I think, again, it is to the difference between the audiences, because maybe why I'm thinking it's more intriguing about the moral aspect of it, when probably, you know, the original audience was more about the whodunit mystery, trying to solve it kind of aspect of it.
Can I ask you a question on a somewhat lighter note?
Yeah, please do. Let's
is is Arbuthnot an English name?
Arbuthnot is an English name, Philip? Or a Scottish name? British. It might be Scottish. I'm just going to Google it.
Because I don't know why. I always imagined that character being played by somebody who's like Indian.
No, definitely English. In fact, he mocks Indian people, doesn't he, in the book? It's an Aberdeen name. It means virtuous or healing. So it comes from Gaelic roots. But yeah, so British and very...
I always thought it was somebody like, you know, in Secret Garden, like British Imperial India.
Yeah,
like that's where I don't know why my brain went there, but...
I think it's going in the right place. And I think that's definitely how we're meant to feel about Colonel Arbuthnot. He is slightly old fashioned and fogeyish. I mean, Mary Debenham's much younger than him, right? And he's come back from British India, and he will have some of those colonial attitudes still lingering in him. So I think we're definitely meant to see that in him for sure. I have a couple of trivial things to say also as we wrap up, which is for those of you who are inspired by books to go traveling, which I am, I've done a couple of Game of Thrones inspired holidays and whatnot. You can take the Orient Express, as I said, it is ludicrously expensive, so maybe out of the reach of most. I would also say that there is a hotel in Syria, if anyone ever makes it to Syria, called Baron's Hotel, which is still standing despite the consequent wars in that part of the world. And that is where she wrote the book. That's where Agatha Christie wrote the book. So you can go to Baron's Hotel, which is quite cool. However, you cannot go to the Tokatlian Hotel in Istanbul, which is where Poirot attempts to check in, because that no longer stands, which is quite sad. But there is a hotel in Istanbul called the Pera Palace Hotel, which really markets itself as the Orient Express Hotel. And you can stay in the Agatha Christie suite, but it isn't the one that appears in the novel. And it isn't the one where she wrote the book. So I find that really hilarious. So just like a PSA, if anyone like wins the lottery and wants to take an Orient Express holiday, by all means, stay in the Pera Palace Hotel. But that isn't actually the one in the novel. So there you go. Anything else to say about this extraordinary book? Incredibly famous.
I do love the character. I can't remember what they say her name is in the book, but it's Linda Arden, basically.
Oh, Mrs. Hubbard. Yeah.
Mrs. Hubbard. Yeah. He quits his job and you are a laughing stock. And then he gets Elaine to go to the bar and like distract his boss while he slips him a Mickey. And there's this actress like loudly going, "What are you doing here?" And she's super obnoxious and like going to give the game away. And the way the character is done in the BBC radio play, you just envision this woman, like a large, obnoxious American. Well, my daughter says this, but then when you realize what's going on and she keeps talking about her daughter, like it's so dark and it's so sad.
Yeah, because she's mourning her daughter, right?
It's so dark.
It's so awful. But it is an interesting book because a lot of people are pastiching different nationalities. Right. So they're kind of like the Swedish missionary who's too good to be true. And, you know, they carry that over into the film. So the latest Kenneth Branagh film, the Willem Dafoe character is actually an American Pinkerton, but he's playing a nasty German Nazi professor. So there are lots of people putting on the kind of a costume of a caricature of a certain nation. But that one, the Mrs. Hubbard one, is absolutely heartbreaking because we realize she's lost her daughter, her unborn granddaughter, her born granddaughter, her younger daughter is now a drug addict. The tragedy is just unbelievable and knows no end. So no wonder. I kind of love the Michelle Pfeiffer version of her because I think it shows the hauntedness and the tragedy in that, okay, she's got justice, but it will never be enough because it can't replace the hole that was left, right? It can't replace loss. Yes.
It's so sad when she's like, my daughter says this, like if my daughter were here. There's a similar episode of Scrubs where Molly Shannon plays like a very obnoxious, talkative character and keeps talking about my son Timmy, he'll always be that age. And then you find out it's that her son is gone and he will truly always be that age. And the characters that were annoyed by her now have great sympathy for her. And it's that kind of storytelling is so tragic and it just really sticks with you in that way.
Any final comments from you, Xander? Or I don't know, do you feel it lived up to the hype? Maybe.
I really enjoyed it. It's a super fun read. I think I'd probably, kind of like I was saying earlier, I'm gonna like give it a few months or something, then do a reread to really just appreciate what the work Agatha Christie put into it.
The technical mastery is audacious and it is to be.
Yeah, I kind of imagine the way she wrote it is the same way Poirot was sitting in the dining car with his, you know, his diagrams and his passports and, you know.
Yeah, exactly. They are as one in this, I think. I think you're absolutely spot on there. It's lovely. And it's Hercule Poirot, arguably at his purest and finest. So I really appreciate that. We're going to roll on with the reread, folks. We've got a slightly weird throwback novel next. Why Didn't They Ask Evans? I'll do a mini pod on that. Doesn't feature Poirot, doesn't feature Marple. It's arguably not a murder mystery. It's one of those P.G. Woodhouse style capers, slightly odd, kind of, that she's doing this 10 years later. We've then got three-act Tragedy and Death in the Clouds, which are both Poirot minor novels, I would argue, which are mini-pod, yeah. But if anyone wants to read them and join in, then please do. The next big one, if you're reading along at home and want to reread with us or read for the first time, which really is, I think it's one of Hannah's favorites, she said it a few times, is The ABC Murders. So that's a really phenomenal book. Famous. So good. I'm hoping, Xander, you'll read it if for the first time if you haven't read it yet, and we'll all hopefully reconvene for that one, if not before. So thank you for joining in, guys. And I'm so pleased you enjoyed it, Xander. It's lovely to find someone who hasn't read it yet who really enjoys it. Because I think people like me and Hannah can become a bit jaded, but yeah. I'm so pleased it gave you pleasure.
Have you read this journey,
Xander?
No, the only Agatha Christie I've been reading is this reread series we're doing. And nice. I'm just reading as we're going along.
Yeah, I'm really curious to see how you find The ABC Murders. I love it. And that one to me has great rereadability. Three-act Tragedy is...
Three-act Tragedy, Death in the Clouds are kind of minor. Like, you can take them or leave them, but ABC...
Three-act Tragedy and Murder on the Links are not my favorite.
I don't think that's the bottom of the barrel for me. But you've got another humdinger. And actually, I think ABC Murders, it's kind of not quite as famous as Orient Express, but I think it is very famous. And I think it's one that really earns it, Xander. So I'm really, really looking forward to seeing what you think of
it. The three that I cannot wait for you to read, Xander, are ABC Murders, Crooked House, and Endless Night. Like, those are my favorite three. And I just cannot wait to hear what you think. The latter two being, like, very different than her normal writing.
Yeah. Oh, man, I'm stoked.
Cool. All right. Well, on that happy and excited note, I'll leave you be. But have a wonderful evening. And to the listener, enjoy reading whatever you're reading. But if you haven't watched Orient Express or read it, then do pick it up, because it's really worthwhile. All right. Have a lovely evening, guys.
Tell Philip who said hi.
Thank you.
Bye.